And Radio Derb is on the air. This is your imponderably genial host, John Derbyshire, with news from far and wide. Well, mostly from near and narrow this week, as I think every one of our news items today is domestic. That comports with the mood of the hour, though. We've got some big, serious problems to deal with here in the USA, and the rest of the world will have to go hang for a while. First and foremost of those problems is our national economy. And within the matter of the national economy, the first order of business for the nation right now, and the first thing a political commentator has to address himself to, is the political fight over raising the debt limit. The story so far. Up to World War I, if the US government wanted to borrow money, it had to ask Congress to approve each act of borrowing. Then, and here you can start hissing and booing if you like, then in October 1917, Congress passed and President Woodrow Wilson signed the Second Liberty Bond Act, which changed the rules, allowing Congress to just set an overall limit for government debt. Since then, the government has been able to borrow as it pleases, within the limit. That's the regime we still live under today. There is a school of thought. Bob Bartlett's been pushing this line, and Senator Chuck Schumer seems to have picked up on it. A school of thought that says the debt limit rules established by that 1917 Act of Congress are unconstitutional, as they violate Section 4 of the 14th Amendment. Quote, "The validity of the public debt of the United States, authorized by law, including debts incurred for payments of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing of insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned." End quote. This was part of the constitutional clean-up after the Civil War, and the main idea was to affirm the validity of Union debt while denying that Confederate debt had any similar standing. Still, you can make an argument that the debt ceiling is unconstitutional, since it's statute law, which is trumped by the Constitution. Well, by all means make the argument, but we've lived so long with the debt ceiling now, it's fixed in people's minds like a law of nature, and if the feds try to spend over it, all hell will break loose, whatever the constitutional lawyers say. The debt limit was first raised past $1 trillion in 1981. Since then, it's been raised 19 times, roughly once every year and a half. The last raise was, in fact, a year and a half ago, in February 2010, to $14.3 trillion. So that's our current debt limit. Since it's been a year and a half since the last raise, you could say it's time for another one. You could say that, except that last raise in February last year was the biggest ever, at almost $2 trillion. Put it another way, just the size of that last increase in the limit was nearly twice as big as the actual limit in Ronald Reagan's first year. Furthermore, that raise last February came with some attached legislation, insisting on pay-as-you-go rules for government spending. That is, any extra new spending on one program had to be matched by equivalent cuts somewhere else. Pay-as-you-go sounds like a great idea, but in fact, whenever Congress adds pay-as-you-go rules to bills, which they've been doing for 20 years to my certain knowledge, they make sure that the rules have enough exceptions and exemptions you can drive a coach and four through them. and that is part of a general principle that applies to all congressional action on spending. Congress is never more cynical than when pretending to restrain federal spending. Any legislation they pass in that regard has more holes in it than a Casey Anthony alibi. And the leakiness is not accidental. Spending restraint legislation is designed to leak. Congress critters live to spend. Even the decent and patriotic minority of them. And don't be too hard on them. They live to spend because that's what we, the great American public, want them to do. You may not want them to, and I don't want them to, but the public at large, Democrat and Republican, wants them to. Ask your nephew on a student loan. Ask your granddad on Social Security and Medicare. Ask your neighbour whose mortgage got bundled up in a Fannie Mae bond. Ask your cousin who works for Lockheed Martin on military contracts. Ask anybody. Well, that's the history. Now here we are in July 2011 with the government operating under a $14.3 trillion credit limit. On the current rate of spending, and that's both spending on actual programs like defence and entitlements, and also payments to holders of government debt, the federal government will bang up against that limit on August the 2nd, less than 4 weeks from now. So, what has to be done? Or if it's not done, what happens? Well, there's a big decision tree of things to do. The first branch of the decision tree is whether to go for radical fiscal reform or not to. By radical reform, I'm talking about major structural changes in spending and or revenue. The radical reform branch itself splits two ways: radical socialist reform or radical free market reform. In radical socialist reform, the federal government takes a controlling interest in key major industries and loads the rest of the private sector down with new taxes and regulations. In radical free market reform, also known as the Dash for Freedom, there is a massive retreat of government. Entire federal departments, energy, commerce, agriculture, education, just for starters, are shut down. The IRS and corporate taxation and the Federal Reserve are abolished. Entitlements are voucherized or privatized. The whole Ron Paul program. Those are the options if you go for radical reform. Naturally, I myself would go for radical reform. I'd go for the Dash for Freedom variety. I've seen socialism at close quarters in several different countries, and you can keep it. Radical reform of those kinds aren't really on the table right now, though. There is no big enough constituency for either socialism or Ron Paulism. My Dash for Freedom would upset all the people who depend on entitlements, or are looking forward to depending on them, and that's a mighty lot of people. The socialist option falls afoul of the fact that too many citizens know too much 20th century history. They know what happens when you crush private enterprise and put government bureaucrats in charge of a peacetime economy. What happens is the USSR at worst, or present-day Greece at the best. So if radical reform's off the table, what's on it? Here, the decision tree takes another branch. No radical reform? Okay then, you have two options. Option one, kick the can down the road, i.e. by raising the debt limit with some kind of conditions attached. Or option two, default. If we choose to kick the can down the road, then the tree branches again. There are half a dozen options for how to kick that can, depending on the conditions Congress attaches. From here on in, it's all politics. Kicking the can down the road-wise, Barack Obama's preference is to kick it past November 2012. Failing that, if we're to have some major crisis between now and then, his very strong preference is that there be some clear way to blame that crisis on congressional Republicans. The first preference explains his offers of compromise, most particularly of spending cuts. Those offers are, of course, bogus. The offered spending cuts are all backloaded. So we hear about $4 trillion worth of cuts in 10 years. But then most of the cuts turn out to be in years 7, 8, 9, and 10. The second preference, the preference that, if some crisis is to occur before next year's election, it can be something he blames on Republicans, that preference explains all the class war rhetoric about corporate jets and oil companies. The president's line will be, "See, I tried to solve these problems, but Republicans were more intent on protecting their pals in big business." Obama's covering all bases here. For congressional Republicans looking to kick the can down the road, which is to say most congressional Republicans, the converse thing applies. Kick it away down the road, but not far enough that it's out of sight next summer. Keep the crisis simmering. It's a risky strategy, given that all the mainstream media will do all they can to help Obama make everything look like the GOP's fault. But it's all they've got, short of radical reform, which they have neither the guts for nor the public support for. If we don't kick the can down the road, then we find ourselves out on the uppermost branch of the decision tree, the one labelled default. In this scenario, Congress does nothing. They just sit on their hands and wait for the poop to hit the propeller. The interesting thing about this option is that nobody quite knows what would happen. To some degree, the president would be in control. He would have to decide who gets paid and who doesn't. In bankruptcy, when a company goes belly up, there is a schedule prescribed by law, a schedule of priorities as to who gets paid after the liquidation of whatever assets the company has left. I forget the details, but I remember that unpaid employees and bondholders are up at the top of the schedule. Trade creditors and holders of common stock are way down at the bottom. There is no such schedule for when a nation can't meet its obligations, and anyway, there's no authority to enforce the schedule, even if there was one. If the USA hits its credit limit on August 2nd, who gets paid and who gets stiffed? With Obama in charge of the decision-making, it would be his client groups who get paid. Unionized public sector workers, welfare recipients, the education rackets, and the race lobbies. The ones stiffed would be bondholders, both foreign and domestic, red states, perhaps military payrolls. Any monies payable to any group not supportive of Obama. But default is really an open situation. Nobody knows the psychological effect on international financial markets. There are sober, serious people who will tell you that a default in August will bring down the whole global system. I don't know enough to refute them. It's an open situation. For just that reason, we'll get some version of kicking the can down the road. Politicians hate open situations. And yet, all that is to talk about the political realities. As a commenter on Larry Kudlow's blog said, sooner or later, political reality gets trumped by real reality. That's why I keep telling you that all these political manoeuvrings are just a shadow play. Politicians are naturally absorbed in the political reality. Behind them, though, the tsunami is building. My guess is that before next year's election, real reality will have taken control. What is real reality going to look like? Well, first off, it's going to look awfully expensive. Lawrence Lindsay, a former governor of the Federal Reserve, had an interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal the other day. Lindsay pointed out that interest rates are abnormally low, so the Treasury is borrowing money at bargain basement rates, less than 3%. The normal rate this past couple of decades has been closer to 6%. If interest rates rise back to that normal level, our payments on the national debt will rise correspondingly, costing us $5 trillion over the next 10 years, easily enough to wipe out the spending reductions in even the boldest plan proposed to Congress. And of course, as I just pointed out, even the boldest congressional plan to cut spending, any congressional plan to cut spending, leaks like a sieve, because it's designed to. And interest rates will rise. Foreign lenders might be willing to lend at lower rates when we're showing signs of a recovery, however feeble. If we stall or go back into recession, they'll be wanting bigger coupons on their bonds. It's the same with growth. The budget Obama proposed in February assumes growth of 4%, 4.5%, and 4.2% in the next 3 years. Historically, though, economies coming out of a major financial crisis plateau at 2.5%, and realistic current projections make it doubtful we'll even attain that. The difference between the rosy numbers for anticipated growth and the pallid numbers for actual growth will translate into additional debt of about $4 trillion just in those 3 years, wiping out the entire 10-year saving that Paul Ryan promised us. Lindsay's article is in the June 28th Wall Street Journal. Its title is "The Deficit is Worse Than We Think." So, here's the bad news once again, folks. The USA is living way beyond its means. We've all got used to doing so. Nobody really wants it to stop, and our elected representatives behave accordingly. And yet, it must stop. As a great economist once observed, if a thing can't go on forever, it won't. The extravagance of our federal government can't go on forever, and it won't. Radical reform will happen. Since there is no public will to make it happen, it will happen against our will. The juggernaut will go over the cliff, and we shall have to live among the wreckage. I predict that the early years of living among the wreckage will be very hard. Hyperinflation will be a factor. So will a general breakdown of law and order. After that, we shall adjust to some new level, grateful just for a degree of stability and security. Our standard of living will be lower. The USA of 2020 will be a seedy, gaunt, hard scrabble kind of place. The retirement age will be 75. Social Security will be means-tested, and instead of going to a doctor when you're ill, you'll self-diagnose with gadgets and buy medicines online from Bangladesh. There'll be no overseas military bases. The US military will be at home in barracks, trying to recover their reputation after putting down the food and gas riots of the mid-2010s. Tumbleweed will be blowing across deserted college campuses. If you want an education, you'll log on to a credentialing agency and work through the course at home, behind the heavy-duty wire mesh covering your first-floor windows. Our children and grandchildren will not be bereft of entertainment, though. When they get tired of watching Indian pop singers or the latest Chinese landing on one of Jupiter's moons, they will amuse themselves by digging up our bones and smashing them to pieces with 14-pound hammers. Other than the coming fiscal catastrophe, the biggest news of this week was the acquittal of Casey Anthony in the murder of her infant daughter 3 years ago. Following the commentary on the acquittal was a bit dismaying. One strong theme was, Casey Anthony is a simply terrible person and therefore she should have been found guilty. On the evidence we have, I will certainly allow that Casey Anthony is an appallingly awful person. Unfortunately, that's not a crime. Crimes have to be proved in court under tried and tested procedures. It's dismaying that so many people seem not to understand this. A 19th century British jurist was just getting into his carriage when a friend came up. "So," said the friend, "you're off to administer justice, then?" Replied the jurist, "Certainly not. I'm off to administer the law." If you don't think justice was done in the Casey Anthony case, I'm of a mind to agree with you. The law was done, though, and in this fallen world, that's as much as we can reasonably hope for. It's more than people in most of the world's countries can hope for, so be thankful you're an American. I mean, if you are an American, no offence to our overseas listeners. The old cliche goes, it's better that 100 guilty men go free than that one innocent man be jailed. I'm a law and order man myself. I want criminals locked up, and preferably set to breaking rocks or working treadmills. The evidence is out there, though, and it's hard to ignore. We do, in fact, lock up a lot of innocent people. Check out innocenceproject.org for some hair-raising cases. All sorts of qualifications need to be introduced there. I had a friend back in England who worked as a probation officer. I asked him one day, how many people in jail are innocent? Innocent of what? He replied. Innocent of the exact thing they were sent down for? 5%. Innocent of anything at all? 0.1%. The cops frame up a lot of people. But they're bad people. We're better off with them in jail. Still, if we're jailing innocent people at the rates suggested, letting the occasional guilty one go free doesn't look so bad. The truly bad types revert sooner or later anyway and end up in a cell. Pop quiz. Where is O.J. Simpson right now? Answer. In Lovelock Correctional Facility as a guest of the Nevada Department of Corrections, serving a 33-year sentence for armed robbery. You see, it all comes out in the wash. So what happened to poor little Kaylee Anthony, who didn't even make it to her third birthday? Well, it's unlikely we'll ever know. My best guess, having raised two kids, is that there was some kind of accident, and Kaylee's dim-witted mother clumsily tried to cover it up. A 2-year-old child is a fragile thing, and even attentive, loving parents will have a few near misses. My son, at about Kaylee's age, had a TV set fall on him, fortunately without any lasting effect. The child of a parent who is not attentive or loving, like, say, Casey Anthony, will be even more prone to mishaps. So here's Casey Anthony looking at a child in a coma or twitching in convulsions and thinking it was her fault. People panic in situations like that. The other possibility is that Casey found the child a hindrance to her partying, clubbing, socializing lifestyle and cold-bloodedly decided to eliminate the problem. I wouldn't rule that out, but such depths of depravity are, thank goodness, much rarer than ill-judged panic after a mishap. I'll go with the panic scenario as more probable. Likely, we'll never know. Casey Anthony might tell us someday, I suppose. But what reason do we have to believe one word out of her lying mouth? I just watched TV coverage of the Atlantis launch, the final space shuttle launch, 30 years and a couple of months after the first shuttle launch. I watched that first launch, too, at rented lodgings in North London. 12 years before that, I watched Neil Armstrong step onto the surface of the moon. The previous Christmas, I'd been spellbound, like everyone else, when Apollo 8 became the first manned spacecraft to go to the moon, even though they didn't land. 3 years before that, I'd gaped with astonishment and disappointment when Mariner 4 sent back the first close-up images of Mars, showing a cratered surface like the moon's. We space buffs had expected to find all kinds of things on Mars. Forests, canals, even cities and people. But craters? It was a letdown, I'll tell you. Before that were the first orbital manned flights, and before that the unmanned moon missions, Ranger and Surveyor. And even before all that, for those of us whose imaginations were caught by the strangeness and immensity of space and by the possibilities of the future, there was science fiction and speculation. Ray Bradbury and Arthur C. Clarke, Asimov and Heinlein. I've lived through the whole business, the entire space age. It's not over, of course. There's every sign that the Chinese and Indians, maybe even the Japanese, are going to persevere with manned space flight, along with the Russians. Commercial space tourism might take off, so to speak, if the entrepreneurs can get the price down. Unmanned space flight is a huge business, both military and civilian, especially military. It's believed that the United States military space budget has exceeded NASA's budget every year since 1982. Scientific space projects would also go on. The New Horizons spacecraft will fly by Pluto 4 years from next week, completing the close-up imaging of what used to be called the Nine Planets, although Pluto's status has since been downgraded to Dwarf Planet. And there will be more missions, I'm sure. What's ending with this last shuttle flight is the age of Americans going into space as part of a national endeavour. That age lasted just 50 years. From Alan Shepard to the present Atlantis crew. May they come home safely. That age really started in the late 1950s, when we saw ourselves as a united people, confident and full of energy, generating so much national wealth we could allow our government to spend a few billion of it on great romantic public projects. We don't think like that anymore. We're not a united people. but a collection of squabbling tribes. We're not confident, we're despondent. Our energy has drained away in lawyering, financial juggling, tribal rancours, and futile wars in places of zero importance. Government-financed manned spaceflight was the last expression of that vigorous, cocky, innocent America of the 1950s. That America is now so far gone, it's considered a bit disgraceful even to talk about it in approving terms. Women were trapped in the kitchen, blacks were barred from voting, Jews were kept out of the country clubs, top tax brackets were confiscatory. You all know the charge sheet. Well, I remember 1950s America, though I only knew it from a distance. With all the blemishes, it was a mighty beacon of hope and imagination to those of us in the rest of the world. And Alan Shepard and Neil Armstrong and the others took that beacon into space. When Atlantis lands on July 20th, July 20th for crying out loud, when Atlantis lands, the last feeble flickers of that beacon will be extinguished. We'll be in a different America. Probably it will be a better America in many ways than the America of the 1950s. But I'm sorry, I won't like it half as much. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Item: convicted murderer Humberto Leal was executed this Thursday in Huntsville, Texas. Leal had raped and murdered a 16-year-old girl back in 1994. He was a Mexican citizen, and a very patriotic one to the end. His last words were, "Viva Mexico!" The Mexican government had done all it could to interfere with the progress of justice, assisted, of course, by Mexico's ambassador in Washington and Mexico's hand puppet in the White House. All to no avail. The ambassador even tried a last-minute appeal to Texas Governor Rick Perry, but Perry refused to pick up the phone. Good for him. I'm liking Rick Perry more and more. Quote from the Associated Press report on Leal's execution, quote, "The Mexican government and other diplomats also contended that Leal's case needed to be thoroughly reviewed." End quote. Excuse me? Thoroughly reviewed? This reptile was sitting on death row for 16 years. Just as many years as his victim, whose name was Adria Sorcida, was on this earth. In 16 years, Leal's case wasn't reviewed thoroughly enough? Ye gods. Oh, and here's a message from Radio Derb to the Mexican ambassador. Nya, nya. Item: news that the Atlanta public school system has been engaged in a huge book-cooking exercise to make its student test scores come out right will not be news at all to anyone acquainted with modern educational practice, or even to anyone who's read my book, We Are Doomed, which has a whole chapter on the stinking pit of corruption, wishful thinking, and barefaced lying that is modern American education. Quote, oh, I'm quoting here from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, July 6th, quote, "For teachers, a culture of fear ensured the deception would continue. APS, that's the Atlanta Public Schools, APS is run like the mob," one teacher told investigators, saying she cheated because she feared retaliation if she didn't. The voluminous report names 178 educators, including 38 principals as participants in the cheating. More than 80 of them confessed. End quote. I called it. Here's a quote from my book, Chapter 6. Quote, when money and jobs are offered to people willing to say they will do something that nobody knows how to do, the results will inevitably be cheating, corruption, and cover-ups. End quote. Ho-hum. There will be a lot more of these stories. Brace yourselves. Under the No Child Left Behind Act, every student has to be above average by 2014. The teachers and the administrators will make sure they are. By any means necessary. Item. As Radio Derb goes to tape here, the June employment figures have just come out. They are terrible. Just 18,000 jobs added in June. That's a net figure. Private businesses added 57,000, while government cut 39,000. All that's happening while more workers come onto the jobs market. 100,000 a month just from legal immigration, which we're not supposed to talk about, except to swear that immigration is a wonderful, wonderful thing. The actual net number of unemployed workers rose almost 175,000 to 14.1 million, pushing up the unemployment rate to 9.2%. On top of that, people who do have jobs are earning less. Average hourly wages declined last month. The forward indicators are dismal too. The average work week declined to 34.3 hours from 34.4, which means that employers demanded less work from their existing staffs. That's the opposite of what happens when companies are planning to hire more workers. This is awful. The economy is basically as flat as a pancake, and actually beginning to crater in places. If it goes back into recession, there's no more stimulus to perk it up. People scoff a lot at my pessimism, but just look at those numbers. If you're not a pessimist right now, you're not paying attention. Item. July 4th came and went since our last broadcast, and I'd like to give a nod here to that. I emit a lot of gloom and doom here on Radio Derb, and I really do think we're going to go through a rough patch before we find some new point of political and social balance, with, I hope, our ancient freedoms still intact. I have to say, though, even for a natural Eeyore like myself, it's hard to be gloomy on the 4th. Those lovely bright flags everywhere, the fireworks, the barbecues and the neighbourly get-togethers. I attended a great one last weekend, and then we hosted a second one. Yes, America's still here, and it'll go on being here in some form or another. We weathered the Civil War, the Depression and the death of vaudeville. We'll weather whatever is coming to us this next 5 years. So, Americans, keep your peckers up. On that uncharacteristically cheery note, ladies and gentlemen, we leave you. Tune in again next week for more from Radio Derb. To see us out, here's Gracie Fields with another dash of cheerfulness. Never say we don't strive for a balanced approach here.